Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
On May 17, 2004, on the 50th anniversary of the landmark Brown v. Board of Education Supreme Court decision, one of America's most enduring and beloved comedians, Dr. Bill Cosby, took to the stage at the Hall for the Daughters of the American Revolution in Washington, D.C., to address an audience gathered by the NAACP and Howard University. The Supreme Court case that was being celebrated that night represented a hard-fought civil rights battle, giving blacks equal access to public education, and was a monumental event in furthering the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s. Most in the audience expected Bill Cosby, star of such shows as I Spy and The Cosby Show, to deliver a lighthearted tribute to those who had made the civil rights victory possible. Instead, what they heard was a speech that, in the words of today's guest, held up a mirror to the conscience of black society. The words he delivered that night became alternatively known as the Pound Cake Speech and the Gettysburg Address. It generated months of debate on the causes of various social ills plaguing the black community, including high dropout rates for inner-city black youth, the increasing number of unwed teenage mothers, and the high incarceration rates of young African-American males. Interestingly, what was missing from much of the discussion in the popular media was the various references Bill Cosby made to religion, the church, and Christians as a community. Seeking to remedy these omissions of critical portions of Dr. Cosby's message, our guest today, Marissa Parson Davis, set out to write a book providing the historical background to that speech and emphasizing the important religious aspects of Bill Cosby's remarks. The resulting book, entitled Bill Cosby is Right, But What Should the Church Be Doing About It, was recently published by Zulon Press. We'll have a link to that book up on our website. Marissa Davis is well positioned to write such a book, as she happens to be the cousin of Bill Cosby, but more importantly, has had the life experience to bring her own personal stories and those of others to bear on numerous critical issues affecting the black community and, by extension, all Americans. Mrs. Davis is a graduate of Liberty University, where she earned a degree in journalism and Christian counseling, and went on to earn a master's degree in theological studies from the same university, and that, by the way, was magna cum laude. She also worked as a news reporter for an NBC affiliate in Charlottesville, Virginia, and currently works as a youth minister and counselor at First Redeemer Church in Cumming, Georgia. She recently helped create the Black Worship Studies program at Liberty University, which will be starting up in 2011. And to top this all off, Marissa is married to Mark Davis and the proud mother of two children, Carissa Joy and Mark Isaac. Marissa, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you so much. My children, they really do top it all off. Motherhood is my greatest accomplishment, and so I talk a lot about my family in the book.
Yeah, you have a great-looking family there. For those of you who want to pick up the book, and I urge you do, because it's a much different read than many of the other books that we've featured here on Research on Religion, because it really does center around Bill Cosby's speech, but really weaves in personal stories that you have gone through, as well as a number of interviews with very famous people, such as Colin Powell and a few other folks, and then puts it into the context of sociological research, and then gives prescriptions.
I started off as a journalist first and then became a theologian, So I think that affects my style of writing.
Yeah, it does, and it's a great read. So for those of you who want to check out the book, please do so at our website, and you'll be able to find and pick it up. It's well worth a purchase. I want to start out by saying that I'm really excited about doing this interview. When I saw your book, and I had to go out and read this, because both you and I are contemporaries. We both grew up in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And during that time, my family, we had a small record collection. We had Beach Boys and Jan and Dean and a few other pop groups of that era. But we also had two comedy albums by Bill Cosby. One was called Wonderfulness, and the other was Why Is There Air? And Wonderfulness was one of my favorite albums, because on the very first track of that one was a, I think it was a 10-minute comedy bit called Chicken Heart, and I would listen to that thing over and over and probably wore a groove deep into that record. And I was also a big fan of The Cosby Show, along with Gilligan's Island and Scooby-Doo. It was probably my three favorite shows of that time.
Yeah, we are contemporaries.
Yeah.
I'm telling my age.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny now talking to somebody, you know, who at that time, you know, was in a different part of the United States experiencing a lot of different things, but now we're back here connected, which is really neat. And Bill Cosby was undoubtedly one of my favorite comedians at that time, because I just played his comedy records over and over. And I have to say, you know, kind of looking back at this now and reflecting upon our interview here, later in my career, you could just see how he's addressing a lot of the serious concerns that he did in the pound cake speech really throughout his entire career. I mean, one could consider not only is he just an entertainer, but the content of his comedy and his entertainment it really gives an intellectual side to Bill Cosby.
Yeah, well, you know, he does have an earned doctorate. And he earned it a little later in life, understanding the importance of education. And, you know, he would do things that were always geared toward education, such as picture pages, the things that he did for young children that would help them to learn to read. And so Dr. Cosby, yes, he is an intellectual. He's a very, very, very bright man. And his style of humor is very family-oriented. So that tells a lot about the kind of person that he is. But what kind of cast a shadow and changed his tone was the death of his son, Ennis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when he went through that, he went through a lot of what I believe soul-searching, and he also became a little harsher. You know, up until that time, you know, everything was wonderful. Things had been kind of going up and up and up and up, and this was a tragedy that kind of just came from left field when his son was killed by that drug dealer in California, and it really affected a lot of things in his life. So when he was kind of fussing at people, you have to understand that some of that was a twinge of pain of what he was going through by losing his only son.
Right, and I think that's a really important context, because this is not just armchair philosophizing and such, but this is, you know, as you mentioned, something that he lived and something that he really had to reflect upon based upon tragic events in his own life. Now, your book is entitled Bill Cosby is Right, But What Should the Church Be Doing About It? Before addressing what the church should be doing, I think we need to set the context of that speech and understand what Bill Cosby was right about. So that's my question to you. What was Bill Cosby right about?
Well, the thing that Bill Cosby was right about is, first of all, the family structure.
Mm-hmm.
Bill has always been an advocate of family, of marriage. He's been married for 47 years now to the same woman, and, you know, all of his children are with the same woman. Well, that's another story. We'll talk about that later. But all of the children with his wife are educated, successful people in society. So when he talks, he knows what he's talking about. He is kind of America's dad.
Right.
And he's a father figure for everybody. And it doesn't matter if you're white or black. He is someone that we all look up to. And he transcends race. Family transcends race. And so it really bothered me when people attacked my cousin for his views, because I knew that he was right, because everything he said in that speech lined up with the Word of God, with the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bible, of course, as Christians, we know is our guidebook for life. So when so-called ministers would attack him, and one of them actually wrote a bestseller called Is Bill Cosby Right? Or Has the Black Middle Class Lost His Mind? And in this book, Cosby's critic accused him of not really taking into account racism.
Mm-hmm.
And really he was said that Bill Cosby was blaming the victim for being poor. He was trying to say that, you know, racism plays a role in black poverty that you're really not addressing because you're so highfalutin and mighty, you've lost touch. And I felt like that wasn't the case. I felt like, especially in the age of Barack Obama, whether you voted for him or not, it says a whole lot that plenty of white people just look past his color and felt like, well, this is the person that's qualified to be the leader of the free world. That says a lot right there.
Right, right, it does.
And it takes away all excuses. So the speech was controversial because people said that it blamed the victim and it didn't really take into account the issue of racism in society that makes so many people poor.
Yeah, that's true. And it generated a lot of controversy or discussion in the popular media, as you note in your book. But again, as I mentioned in the introduction, it really, that discussion that was generated neglected the role that religion or the church played or Bill Cosby's challenge to Christians in there. Why do you think that was missing from the conversation that occurred after the speech?
I've sat in newsrooms, and I've been in a newsroom, news environment, and they tend to ignore religion. They don't want to talk much about religion unless it seems like they want to talk a lot about the Muslim faith. But when it comes to Christianity, most people in newsrooms think they're above Christianity. I was persecuted. I was harassed, straight up harassed as a believer when I worked in the news media. And I will tell you straight up that you have a lot of atheists and a lot of people who are just straight up hostile towards Christianity. So when it came down to it, the news directors just conveniently left all of the references to the church and God and faith out of the speech. And when I began to write my book in 2006, I pulled up the entire speech online, and I was like, oh my goodness, this man is addressing the black church. He is talking directly to Christians. And the popular news media had totally blown over what he had to say about that, focusing instead on maybe 30 seconds of what he did say. And you cannot put the whole context of what he was trying to say in 30 seconds soundbite or a minute story. So I decided to write a book.
Well, I'm glad
you are talking about it.
I'm glad you did. And you address a number of different social ills within that book. And what's nice is you usually start with a quote by Bill Cosby from that speech. And then you reflect back upon it and give a little bit of the historical context, a little bit of the sociological data on that problem. And then, you know, finish off with some of the recommendations that you have for the black church and Christians in general. This isn't just a book directed at the black church, but it's really directed at all Christians.
Which is an excellent aspect
of the book. So let's start by talking about one of the issues that you address early on, and that's education. And of course, the Bill Cosby speech, the pound cake speech, as it was known. Actually, before we move on to that, why was it called the pound cake speech for the listeners in our audience who might not be familiar with why it got that term?
Well, you know, Dr. Cosby is a comedian.
Right.
So some of what he had to say was humorous in a dark kind of way. And he was talking about how in the African-American community, we have a lot of senseless stuff that goes on between the police and people who do petty crimes. And these petty crimes escalate into confrontations with the police, and the next thing you know, something really small, like someone walking in a convenience store and stealing Coca-Cola and pound cake. He just made that up off the top of his head.
Mm-hmm.
And then they run off, and the police say, stop, stop, or I'll shoot. And they keep running, and the next thing you know, someone is shot in the head over stealing Coca-Cola and pound cake. And he said it's so stupid. He was poking fun in a dark way at the senseless crimes that escalate and end up in loss of African-American life. And so that's how the speech began to be called the pound cake speech, because of his references to stealing pound cake and Coca-Cola. And also, it became known as the Gettysburg Address, because he was addressing the issues that are in our inner cities So it became, like the Gettysburg Address, it became known as the Ghettosburg Address. And that's just another humorous attempt at the news media, by the news media, to refer to his speech. But it really was, I refer it to as the speech heard around the world, because it was a news issue for a long time, and it really still is. You know, years later, we're all still talking about it.
Right.
A lot of Caucasian people think, well, that's old news. Oh, but the black people know this is not old news at all. Issues of family are timeless.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I said, Bill Cosby is America's, he's America's dad. So the issues needed to be addressed. And so, again, that's part of the reason why I wrote the book. But I would also say that a major reason why I wrote the book is because of the leading of the Spirit of the Lord. When I was involved in seminary, the president of the Bible College looked me straight in the eye and said, "Sister, you know, I really think that you need to write a book." And I was shocked because he did not know that I had a journalism background.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, "Mary, I kept these things in my heart and I pondered them. Didn't even tell my husband." But within a very short period of time, I had other people in ministry that I respected tell me the same thing. "Sister, you need to write a book. You'd be really good as a book author. You need to consider writing a book." So that's when I realized that the Spirit of the Lord was leading me to write on these issues, because we have, the church is the answer. You know, it's not enough to just sit there and pontificate and talk about the problem. There are answers in the Word of God, and the church should be part of the solution and not part of the problem.
Yeah, that's what's really great about the book, too, is you offer a number of prescriptions for the number of the social ills that you're talking about here. Let's start with the one you addressed early on, and that's education, you know, coming back around to that point. And, of course, the Bill Cosby speech, the speech heard around the world, as you say, was given during a celebration of the Brown versus Board of Education court case. And it was really centered around the issue of education, but Bill then branched out to a number of other social ills. But let's stick with education right now and provide us some background on the struggle behind Brown versus Board of Education and how that related to you personally, and what transpired within the black community since that landmark court decision in 1954.
Well, you know, in the South, things took a couple of years to get implemented after Brown versus Board of Education. And I grew up in Central Virginia. And in Central Virginia, they had what they call massive resistance, which is that even though the court case had been decided in the Supreme Court, there were a lot of localities that decided that, hey, we're going to do what we want to do. And so they took issues into their own hands. And I grew up in rural Buckingham County, Virginia, but the next county over was one of the court cases that was part of Brown versus Board of Education. And in Prince Edward County, Virginia, they decided that they would rather close the schools than integrate. So what they did was they closed the schools, closed down all the schools, black and white. But then they turned around and started their own private academies, rehired all the public school teachers, the white public school teachers, and had the private academy. And then they handed out what they call school vouchers, which kind of surprised me because you still hear about school vouchers today.
Right.
And that's what they used to circumvent the law.
Mm-hmm.
So in Prince Edward County, the next county where I was, the county right next to where I was born, you had a lot of black people that had to be shipped out to Buckingham County or to surrounding counties or live with relatives outside of the locality because of the fact that they closed down all the schools rather than integrate. So the officials in Buckingham County sat back and watched all this. And when they decided to integrate the schools, and my sister, my oldest sister Melody, who was about 50, 51 years old, was one of the first black students to set foot in a previously all-white school. And so the integration issue was really close to home. My parents were a little worried because of all the mess that had gone down at Prince Edward. When they put us on the school bus, they were very watchful. They kind of kept an eye out. but they never let us know that they were worried, because they felt like if we talk about it, then they'll be nervous and they'll be anxious and not be able to learn. So they just kind of kept it all quiet, and my mother prayed about a lot of things. But things went a lot more smoothly when it came to integration in Buckingham County because of what had gone down next door. They just looked at that mess, and they decided they didn't want to have part of it. But I will tell you this, when it comes to education, a story about education in Buckingham County. I went to go see a movie this weekend. It was a great movie, and it had Denzel Washington in it. Denzel Washington's father was the janitor at my high school.
Wow.
And you won't find it in the biographical information. They always said that he was a preacher. But his dad was the janitor. His dad was born right in the town of Dilwyn, Virginia, where the schools were located, where I went to, Dilwyn Elementary School. And because of the struggle, because of what we went through, Denzel Washington was able to go to college, get his degree, move on to Hollywood, become a mega millionaire, and gives God all the credit for what he has achieved in life and who he is. And it's because of what went down right in Buckingham County and in Prince Edward County, where I'm from. So I just had to just throw that in there because of all we've gone through to get to where we need to be. But yet there are a lot of people that have missed the boat.
Yeah, and what is really neat about how you set this up is, you know, setting up the struggle to get equal access to education and fair treatment, which for you is a very personal story. And then reflecting upon this some 40 years later or so, and seeing the high dropout rates, it's one could only imagine, oh, wow, we went through this struggle really to earn these these civil rights here, and what are we doing with that situation now? And so that's one of the things that really bothered Bill Cosby, and I think, you know, for you as well, is the state of education among black youth today. And so what can you say about that?
Well, I would say that, yes, we have many people who do not really realize the struggle and what we went through, and they don't really esteem education like they should. I believe the Bible teaches that wisdom is the principal thing, and all you're getting, get understanding. So because I understand this, I just have always had a love for knowledge. I think that being born into a Christian family, I think that reading the Bible, family devotions, memorizing scripture, I think it touched my mind. To the point where I was able to retain knowledge maybe a little bit more easily than other people because I was always memorizing. So memorization came easy to me because I was in the house learning Bible verses. But I would say that we have a lot of people today because they don't really read the Bible and don't have an understanding that wisdom is the principal thing. When it comes down to it, they don't really esteem it. And I think part of the problem is the lack of family structure. You know, I came home to a warm meal. My mom cooked. She stayed at home. She took care of us and met our needs. And there was a chaos in my home environment. We had the lights on every night. We had running water. We had all these wonderful things that was able for us to focus on our education. Mm-hmm. But not a lot of people don't have that.
Right.
Because they didn't grow up in a Christian family or a dysfunctional family. So we have a number of dropout issues. And in Atlanta, the dropout rates are high in the African-American and the Mexican-American, brown, people of color. And in my book, I talk about the top five reasons dropouts identify as major factors for leaving school. And number one, they said the classes were not interesting. Well, life is not always going to be interesting, and any job that you have is going to be some dull and boring stuff. So that's not a very good excuse, in my opinion, but it's the number one reason.
Mm-hmm.
47% of the dropouts gave that as a reason. The number two reason was that they missed too many days and could not catch up. Well, that's the parents' fault, because who should have made them go to school? Were they hanging out in the street or something like that? You should know where your kids are. 42%, spent time with people who were not interested in school. That is a high reason. That's number three. Again, my parents were on top of us, and we didn't hang around with losers. You know, eagles fly with eagles, and if you fly with a bunch of turkeys, that's what's going to end up happening. But my parents were very selective about who we spent time with. Reason number four was that they had too much freedom and not enough rules in life. That's 38% of the reasons of the dropout reasons. So that's, again, family structure, not enough structure. And then another one was failing in school. That's 35%. These are all factors that if the family was together, you know, a lot of these issues would take care of themselves. And in my case, you know, my parents had a wonderful marriage. So we all graduated from high school. We have one sibling is my sister. I'm very proud of her. She is a professor at Liberty as well. Has her PhD, graduated from the University of Virginia. Another sister's a lawyer. Another sister got her master's degree from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary studying music. And then I got my master's, and then my brother did not want to be left behind, and he's working on his master's as well. So we're all stable, financially stable. Never had a car or a house repossessed or foreclosed. And I'm thankful for all this because of the foundation that Liberty University gave my family, because all five of us went there.
Oh, fantastic. I want to talk a little bit about Liberty University in the, a little bit later on here. But the one of the things that resonated with me when you were talking here was the importance of the family structure and how that related to education. I remember in Bill Cosby's speech, he had a passage where, and I'm just going to paraphrase this, where, you know, when you came home from school or where you're going to school, every window that you passed was an eye upon your behavior. So the community and the families in that community were really watching to make sure, you know, that the kids got into school and that they weren't hanging around with the bad eggs and such.
Yeah, that is true. Back then, you know, there was more of an attitude of love thy neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
Today we live in neighborhoods where you don't even know your neighbor. There's so much transience. It wasn't like that back when Bill Cosby grew up. And what he said was, and I got the quote here, "Ladies and gentlemen, the lower economic and lower middle economic classes are not holding their end in this deal. In the neighborhood that most of us grew up in, parenting is not going on. In the old days, you couldn't hooky school because every drawn shade was an eye. And before your mother got off the bus and to the house, she knew exactly where you had gone, who had gone into the house, and where you got on, whatever you had on, and where you got it from. Parents don't know that today." And that was because people used to look out for each other, and they were just a little nosy. And so they would come, you know, get on the phone as soon as mom came home and give a report if anything was out of line. And so you're right, it's not the same anymore.
Now, you had a chance in your book to interview a number of people based upon your journalism degree. You had that, you know, great access to people and the skill set to really probe a number of different people here. One of the people that you interviewed was Colin Powell, and you asked him about the state of education in Black America today. What did Colin Powell have to say about Bill's thoughts on Black education?
Well, he said that for the most part, he agreed with Bill to a large measure. And so, you know, I read quotes from the speech, and we sat down and we discussed them via phone with his office in Washington, D.C. And I asked him straight up, you know, a lot of very probing questions. And It was like a miracle that I got the interview in the first place. I about dropped the phone when they called and said that they would do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, you know, really prayed about what questions to ask, and I sat there and presented them. And, you know, I just talked about his own family. He has a wonderful family himself. He has a good marriage with his wife. And so I asked him, you know, about child rearing and what he did to raise such successful young people, and he gave very honest answers. And he just talked about the structure in the military and how it was good for their particular family. And he also talked about how he was gone a lot, but his wife was there.
Mm-hmm.
He was being the breadwinner, but his wife was there. And they were a team effort. We talked also about JROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about how his work in implementing Junior ROTC classes and different schools around the country. And then he talked about his work in mentoring young people. And with his own church in particular, I asked him, you know, what can churches do to help with the dropout crisis? Because dropout issues are something that are near and dear to General Powell's heart. He started a foundation to address the issues. And he is very active in the community and wanting to do something. And his heart is right. He's really looking out for young people. He has just seen a lot of changes as years have gone on. And he is a little bit in denial, really, about how bad family situations are in the African-American community. I think it's a little pride. I don't think he really wants white folks to know just how bad it is. But because he knew that he was going to be in the media. But the fact of the matter is he brought up some very salient points about what we all can do. And he pointed out that, you know, in the middle and upper classes, none of us are really doing enough. You can't do enough
mm-hmm.
to try to reach out and help someone else to show them the way.
That brings up this issue about what the churches can do, and this is how, you know, each of your chapter develops a theme and then and finishes off with, you know, what churches can do. And from your perspective, and also interviewing a number of other people, you reflect upon this. So what can or what have black churches and white churches, how have they respond to the different challenges of education in the inner city, and what could they do more?
Well, the church is the answer. I really believe that it is, because, again, when the word of God gets into people, and the Holy Spirit can touch their mind. So General Powell talked about his home church, and he goes to, I believe it's the Episcopal Church in downtown D.C., and it is a Caucasian church. He is of the minority in that church, but what he has done is implemented a program within the church, whereas they've reached out and reached out to a school and actually have like a mentorship type program where the families in that rich white church go across the railroad tracks and mentor these young inner city kids. And what they do is they invite these kids into their homes and they have pool parties and just kind of show them that there's a different way of living.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so they're able to be exposed to something and have something to reach toward. And the white families mentor these young black children, many from single-family homes, over the summer, and they really do it intensively. And so I talk about how, you know, there's other programs that are in place that are very similar to what General Powell had in his church. And I talk about a great pastor that I really think highly of, Pastor Tony Evans,
mm-hmm.
and in his church out in Texas, and they have started a project called Project Turnaround.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, and I think it's a wonderful program. And what they do is they adopt schools. And his particular church, it's a mega church, it's Oak Cliff Bible Fellowship. He was very concerned about Dallas's troubled and violence-plagued public schools, so he found a way that his church could help. And the program started by sending 12 of their deacons to walk the halls of one particular school. And then the change that happened was remarkable. Peace came over the school because of the presence of these men of God. The absenteeism went down. There were a caring male figure in many of these young people's lives, and they were walking the halls every day. The grades started going up, and it was remarkable. So they implemented the program and started teaching other churches how they could do the same thing. So they have a conference, I believe, every year where they invite churches to come in and show them how they can replicate the program in their communities. And it's just remarkable when Christians get involved. And I would like to say that the black church is powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And look what has happened through the civil rights struggle. I'm here in Atlanta, so I see the history every day.
Right.
Whenever I have family come into town, we always go to the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change, and we go through the exhibit. I'm living it here. This is what the black church, when black preachers and black deacons, and when they get up and they decide and they put their mind together to be organized and to make a change, the change was remarkable. Laws were changed. Society in general had changed because Christians made up their mind that they weren't going to take it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm calling for, within the black community, a neo-civil rights movement. We need to quit worrying about what white folks are doing. That's basically what I'm trying to say. We need to concern ourselves with our own families and with our own struggles and try to improve the situation in our own communities. And education is one of the ways that we could do that. And that's what Tony Evans did with Project Turnaround. And I think it's remarkable. And it needs to be in churches and inner cities all across America.
Yeah, it was quite an amazing discussion you had of that in your book. And it really, really affected me. And what's amazing about that was just the simplicity of it, having the presence in the school, being a role model, and just walking the halls. Is really what it took to turn around a lot of lives of these kids, and it's been having such a wonderful effect. One of the things that you also talk about in your book, in that Bill Cosby's speech was on the anniversary of the Board of Education, but you mentioned another very important court case that came after the Brown versus Board of Education, and
yeah,
maybe had an
Murray
opposite effect. That was Murray versus Curlett. And what was Murray versus Curlett about, and how has that affected the black community?
Well, it was 1963, and it was we all know who Madeline Murray or Hare is. She was the atheist that didn't want prayer in schools. Essentially, she was the one that got prayer and God and Bible reading kicked out of our school system. And that was, again, 1963. And essentially, all of this was kind of swirling around at the same time. So one thing I noticed, I was like, wow, we were gaining our civil rights, but we were losing our moral rights. So even though our schools were segregated and our black schools were run down and maybe tore up and had shabby books, but there was still prayer and Bible reading in the schools back then.
Mm-hmm.
People still knew how to get to heaven. People still understood how to respect their elders and knew what the Ten Commandments were. Today, you go out in the street and you ask your average high school student what the Ten Commandments are, they just look at you like you're crazy. They can't answer that. Even grown Christians, people sitting up in church for years, if you ask them what the Ten Commandments are, you'll get maybe 8, 7, if you're lucky. And that's in black and white churches. So the reality of it is that biblical literacy is going down in society. So that's part of that is the church's fault as well, because now we have these huge mega churches, and in a lot of these mega churches, you don't even have Sunday school anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The Sunday school is on the decline. And if people come to church, they just come, you know, at 11 o'clock, and then they want to go real quickly. They don't want to put the time in to learn the Bible. So with us not learning it in school like we used to do a generation or two ago, biblical literacy is on the down, is on the slide, and therefore you have an increase in violence. Because when you leave when you leave out the restraining power of the Holy Spirit, then, you know, the devil just takes over, and the fruit of the Spirit leaves, which is the love, the gentleness, the meekness, and you have a bunch of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very sad. And in my book, I address black-on-black violence and the increase of domestic violence in our communities. These things have existed for a long time, and they're just they're getting worse now that the Bible is out and people just don't know, and a lot of people are just not saved.
Yeah.
And then they're sitting up in church trying to be pastors, and it's a mess.
Well, let's go ahead and go down that path a little bit. And I want to bring up chapter 4 of your book, which deals with the high rates of incarceration among young black men today. And what was Bill Cosby's concerns about this? Why, in your opinion, was he right? And more importantly, and this is what I really liked on page 123 of your book, you raised an interesting and challenging question. You said, is the black church ignoring the problem of black male incarceration? And I'd like to get your answer and perspective on that.
They are. They are really ignoring it. I interviewed, for this particular chapter, I interviewed my cousin, who is a retired chaplain. He worked with Good News Jail and Prison Ministry, which is a white organization. Now, you go up any jail in this country, and it's going to be majority brown and black. So here it is that the white church, the Southern Baptist churches, recognize that there's an issue and a need and funded his salary all those years. He retired after about 30-some years with Good News Jail and Prison Ministry. And I kind of got upset about that. And I was like, you know, here we are. We have mega church pastors running around in private jets, dealing and preaching the prosperity message. And yet, you know, maybe they could just fly first class and give up some of that money and build up a prison ministry. You know, it kind of got me mad because I'm like, you know, we should be taking care of our own. But I'm glad that the Southern Baptist, you know, of which I am one, felt the need to do this and to fund my cousin in the prison ministry for all those years, but it really kind of got me upset that we really don't have anything like this by some of our major denominations. And so I attribute it to the prosperity message, because once they come out of jail, they can't make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So why should the church pay a lot of attention to them, because they've been left out, you know, of the prosperity message, which they preach all the time.
And you're somebody
so
who...
it kind of makes me upset.
Mm-hmm. And you're somebody who really practices what they preach. You call for, you know, greater black church involvement in prison ministry, but you're somebody who's been there in the trenches. You've gone into prisons and have ministered to a number of people, and you've seen how that's changed their lives. You give a great story about Warren Savage in your book. And tell us a little bit about that.
He was a former news anchor who got caught up. He got caught up. He was on the number one station here in Atlanta. He has held that job for about 10 years. I'm very picky about who I watch on television, because I used to be a news anchor. So my talent, what I consider to be very talented is a very high standard. I don't just watch just everybody. But he was my favorite. And in the morning, I like to hear his voice over everybody else's. And there are a bunch of news stations here in Atlanta with morning programs. So every day when I get up and get ready to go to work, when I was working outside the home, I'd always turn him on and watch him. Well, then he got caught up in drugs, and he quit his job, and he was very arrogant when he quit his job. And this is about $250,000, $300,000 a year job that he just quit. He just up and quit one day. And the news media reported on it and said that, "I'd rather get the H out than sell out." And right then and there, the Holy Spirit showed me he was on drugs. Because you don't just quit a $300,000 a year job or something stupid, you know, unless you are really caught up. And one thing I know about dealing with people who are drug addicted, that spirit is very arrogant. So I knew how drug use is very commonplace in media and in entertainment in general. So the Holy Spirit showed me he's on drugs. And I sat there, I told my husband, I said, "That man's on drugs." And my husband sat there, argued with me about it. I said, "No, he's on drugs, because you don't just don't quit a job like that unless there's something else going on." And it turned out that I was right. It showed up later in news stories. And he eventually was caught very close to my church, my new church where I was going to Bible college. My new Caucasian church that had a prison ministry. and he got caught with his dealer in a considerable amount of the stuff. And as you know, I was vindicated. I told my husband, "See, I told you so." But it was very, very troubling for me because I felt like we couldn't afford to lose one more of our young men, and especially somebody who was degreed and successful.
Right, very high profile as well. Yeah.
Yes, I couldn't sleep at night, so I ended up couldn't sleep. It was like God was just couldn't let me sleep, and I said, "Okay, God, I'll go to the jail and I'll talk to this man." And I did. I prayed for him. And I asked him a very hard question. It really wasn't very hard. I said, "Would you rather do what these redneck prison guards are telling you what to do, or do what God is telling you what to do?" And it took him about 2 seconds to make an intelligent choice. We knelt down there in the prison, prayed the sinner's prayer, and I told him what God had to say, which is that you need to be preaching the gospel. This is why you're going through all this. And if you had been up in the house of God, none of this would have happened. So it was a very dramatic story. It was eventually reported on by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. And Warren is out. He went through rehab, 18 months of rehab. He's out. He's off drugs. He still is preaching a little bit today. And he's my spiritual son. And I pray for him, and I always kind of look out for him.
And that's great. I mean, it's a wonderful story in the book, and you know how you do this is you really bring these personal stories, down, to that personal level. So it's not just something abstract that's out there, but this is really how prison ministries and how the churches can actually affect people's lives on a daily basis. And in your book as well, you provide a number of links to a number of different prison ministries that you talk about. We'll put up some of those links on our website so that people can check these out, because your recommendations, I think, in many ways are spot on here. Let me continue on this, and you just mentioned before about the issue of domestic violence. And that, kind of is part of the problem with incarceration and such. Tell us about that, the domestic violence and also black-on-black violence that people often don't focus on very much. And why is that important? What did Bill Cosby have to say about that? What are some of your thoughts?
Well, black-on-black violence is not a very sexy subject. But we have to study it. It needs to be studied because it's a major issue in every inner city here across America. But yet it doesn't get federal funding. I think our African-American schools should be studying the problem. Here in Atlanta, we have a number of black schools, historically black colleges, and I think they should be leading the fight and studying these issues. But instead, a lot of times we just want to look at what white folks are doing to us instead of looking to what we are doing for ourselves, doing to ourselves. And so I highlight the story that was in the news media of and I wasn't being salacious or anything. I was just reporting the facts of Evangelist Juanita Bynum and her husband Bishop Weeks, who had a big, huge $1 million wedding on television, and then after just a few years after the wedding, they were in the news again. They were on television again because he actually beat his wife down. He beat her down, as we say in the black community. It was a beat down in the parking lot next to the Atlanta airport, whereas he was kicking her all over her body, stomping on her, kicking her everywhere, and it said, and it was, quote, in the transcript, "I'm going to kill you." And this is someone who claimed to be a minister, someone who was the head of a very big church. And there's always a church scandal here in Atlanta every couple of years, always a big church scandal. And it's in the black churches. And there's white church scandals as well, so the media gives equal time.
Right.
At least. But, it was just like, gosh, how could people, what is going on? What is going on when the preachers are acting like this? Got a big, huge house, got driving a Range Rover, living in a $2 million house, which, by the way, is very close to my, again, back to my home church in Cumming, Georgia, where they live was out that way in the rich white area, and it was just amazing. And then, of course, the media always loves the report on when preachers fall.
Right.
It's very salacious. It makes great news, And so it was all up in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and all up to the point where they got their divorce, and they covered the divorce very frequently, and it was a mess. It was one hot mess,
mm-hmm.
hot celebrity mess. And yet they're still both in ministry today.
Mm-hmm.
He's still preaching, and she's still preaching. And I'm like, what is wrong with people that they want to sit up under this? You know, people are just not looking at the facts. They're not looking at the facts. They're not really taking the time to think about what is really going on and doing the research. They just get blindly loyal. And part of the reason is because we as Christians, for the most part, are trusting. I mean, that's how we got saved. We believe what somebody told me. We believe what the preacher had to say about saying this prayer. And so within the very nature of faith and faith-based community, there is a belief, there's an ability, well, there's a tendency to believe what you're told. But I'm a journalist. I'm just a little skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
I trust but verify. I take it to the Bible for myself. In the words of Ronald Reagan, I think that's what he said, trust but verify. So, you know, and I just examined the problem. I examined the problem from a biblical perspective. And a lot of black leaders want to blame the man, the plantation system that we had here in America for so many years, for explaining why we have this black-on-black strife. I say, oh, no, it goes back further than the plantation, baby. It goes all the way back to Cain and Abel. Because what the strife and brother-on-brother violence begins when you start envying and coveting what someone else has instead of wanting to work and pray and get your life right and do what it takes for you to get the blessing too. So I talk about that. And I just talk about the increase of violence in the United States. I could talk about it. Sadly, there's plenty to talk about. There's a lot to talk about in this issue, so... I can bend your ear, and I am.
We're running a little bit short on time, and there's a lot of other things that you cover in the book, which, you know, I want to highlight as well. You talk about, you know, one of the things that you're talking about, coveting thy neighbor's wealth. In Chapter 7, you talk about consumerism within the black community,
yeah.
and how that is contrasted with the role of entrepreneurship. And this was a chapter that I, being a political economist, I love economic questions and such, but this is one that, a chapter that really resonated with me there. And talk about, again, this is set up with thoughts from Bill Cosby's speech, but you really bring it home by, you know, talking about this difference between, you know, consumerism and the need for entrepreneurial innovation. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you have to understand, in the black community, for so many years, we didn't have anything. So now that we have an opportunity to get something, sometimes the things are taking more of a focus in our lives than what they should be. And like I said, I talked a little bit about the prosperity message and the damage that it's done in many of our churches. And don't get me wrong, I'm for prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I point out is that I always talk when I talk. I didn't necessarily bring it out in my book. But when I talk about how the Apostle Paul, he wrote half of the New Testament, was a prophet, an evangelist, a church planner, was a key figure in the church in the early days. Yet the Apostle Paul had a skill and went out and earned money. He was a tent maker.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we have so many of these preachers that don't think it's necessary for them to really have a secular job. They just want to earn all their money off the church and want to live a highfalutin lifestyle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, what's wrong with this? And so many in the congregation just swallow that.
Yeah.
You know, they just think, well, you know, my preacher should live high in the hog and really... you should have a private jet and you should have all this stuff. Instead of sometimes questioning, you know, is this really the best resource and use of God's resources? Because they're all living in a mansion with golden chandeliers and marble floors, yet you walk up in their churches and they're very basic.
Right, right.
Very basic. And you know, there's no marble and stained glass and, you know, their churches, their houses looking better than God's house. And my Bible tells me this is wrong when that's like that. And I talk about, the prosperity message, and I talk about how, we just tend to spend, and not think about tomorrow. And the foreclosure crisis is part of that mindset.
Mm-hmm.
People overextended themselves and got houses that they really couldn't afford, and then showed up in church testifying about how God blessed them. No, God didn't bless you with that because you were outside of your means. You did it to yourself. And then when you lost the house a couple of years later, don't blame God.
Yeah.
Because you really sat down and lived within your means.
Yeah, that it's a great chapter. It really got me thinking about the prosperity gospel quite a bit, and how, that oftentimes can be viewed as, wealth just comes easy, but it's not just that God blesses us, but he blesses us through, our hard work and gives us our talents that we have to really work hard for his glory in that. And you bring that home in that chapter, which I think is a very important aspect.
Talk about the high failure rate of businesses in the black community,
right,
and what churches can do to help increase the success rate. And I've just known so many Christians over the years, people I know, church folks, who started out their businesses and just thought that God was with them. And they didn't survive because it was a good idea, but it wasn't a God idea.
Mm-hmm.
They got greedy, they got caught up, and they stepped out in areas where they didn't have understanding and didn't train themselves before they stepped out, and it's pretty sad. So because of my family's entrepreneurial background and my husband's business as well, I think that uniquely qualifies me to talk about it.
Yeah, your husband, he's an insurance agent, if I'm correct?
Yes, he's a State Farm insurance agent, and we believe God to get that agency, and we've been there in Stone Mountain since 1998, and we're very thankful for it, and it's provided his family a decent living.
Mm-hmm.
And, I have a nice car, don't get me wrong. God has taken care of us, and I'm thankful, but I don't worship that, don't worship it at all. And I put it in its proper perspective. I think that there's a lot of worshiping the golden calf in a lot of our black churches. I hate to say it.
Yeah.
I speak the truth in love. I really do.
There's a whole lot more going on in this book. And again, we're running short on time, and I urge people to go out and get this book, because we haven't even scratched the surface on a number of other issues you talked about, such as marriage and a few other issues that are out there, and marriage is a very important one that, as you mentioned, Bill Cosby has been married to his wife for 40 plus years and, really provides a role model for a lot of people in how he raises his children. But I want to spend our last few minutes here talking about what you are doing in terms of bringing a lot of the thoughts in your book to life, not only in the black church and the black community, but in academia. As I mentioned at the outset, you're part of an effort at Liberty University to establish a black worship studies program, which looks like it's going to be going live in winter of 2001. So tell us a little bit about that and your relationship with Liberty University and what you're trying to do to bring a lot of your ideas home to academia.
Well, a lot of what people don't know is that Liberty University is a very diverse campus.
Mm-hmm.
They have about 20% minorities. I would say about 12% black, and then the rest is the other 8% is others, Asians, Filipinos, people from India. But we have a very, very decent percentage of African Americans that are on campus. And in talking with the pastors in the black churches, they realized there was very much of a need for worship leaders, people to lead in the singing. We have an abundance of talent in the black community, but not so many people who are trained in music,
mm-hmm,
and also ministry,
mm-hmm,
because anybody that's up front is a ministry leader, and they should be able to know the Bible. They should be have a lifestyle that is worthy of being examined. So Liberty University began talking with leaders in the African-American church, such as in the Church of God in Christ, Bishop Charles Blake, who was the head of one of the largest black denominations with millions of members. And they met with Bishop Blake and other pastors, very prominent pastors here in Atlanta and other communities. And they sat down and began to formulate what was necessary when it came to people to lead the praise and worship. And they came up with a degree program called the African American Worship Studies Concentration for the Center of Worship.
Mm-hmm.
So it's music, dealing with the praise and worship leaders. Now, because we're in a recession, and when white America gets a cold, black America gets pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
So money is tight in the African American community right now. So they put off the program for a while. But they're starting out with certificates in different areas, being led at different churches as pastors give support. So it's kind of a traveling program at this point. It started off, starting off in Alabama, and they're going to have it here in Atlanta as well. And hopefully the pastors are being very supportive. Bishop Charles Blake has been very extremely supportive because in many of our seminaries, they're not really graduating the people who are very, in the black seminaries, they're not graduating people who are trained in the style of worship that is particular to the African-American church. And I believe our music is wonderful and beautiful and worthy of mm-hmm. being studied.
Absolutely.
Some people might criticize, oh, that's being divisive. Well, you know what? When you're in the Center for Worship, it's just an option. If you want to take it, you can. And we even have some, you know, Caucasian people who are interested in our music
mm-hmm.
and want to study and learn how to blend their style of worship with ours. So the program is open to everybody. It's not divisive.
Yeah, so I particularly like about that. I love black gospel music and have been a fan for it for quite some time. It's very inspirational, and it's wonderful that you're bringing this program to Liberty University because, you know, what you talk about through your entire book is about, you know, taking the ideas in Bill Cosby's speech, thinking through them in a rational or, you know, logical way to their conclusions, infusing it with biblical knowledge, and then giving prescriptions out here for the black church, for actually for all churches. And in you're putting that into practice at Liberty University, and it's really great to see that they're picking up the baton that, you know, you've been carrying for a long time and that. So I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion. I want to wish you
Thank you so much. Also, we'll be teaching a class.
Oh, great.
African American Women's Ministry as an adjunct. They've asked me to do that, so I'm going to be working as a professor. It's a dream. It's always been a dream of mine.
No, that's great.
To publish and be a professor, so I'm just thrilled that that God has brought it to pass.
It's a great job. Well, thank you again, Marissa Davis. Her book is Bill Cosby is Right, But What Should the Church Be Doing About It? It's available at Amazon.com and a number of other booksellers, so I urge you to pick it up. And again, thank you very much for being on Research on Religion.
God bless you for asking me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.